on me.
The complicated system could produce good, bad, and ambivalent answers to all these questions. Assuming that the customers took the responses seriously, and some might have been as sceptical as many horoscope readers now, "You won't be caught as an adulterer" was obviously rather better than "You will be caught as an adulterer, but not for some time." "You haven't been poisoned, but you have been bewitched" would merely have raised another anxiety, while "The traveller is alive, he is on his way" would, in most circumstances, have been cause for celebration. Throughout, there is a lingering tone of resignation about the responses. "Wait, not yet, be patient, and don't expect it" are repeated words of advice. This is a tone also captured in the only genre of mainstream Roman literature that can claim an origin outside the world of the elite, the animal fable. The most famous of these stories were attributed to Aesop, supposedly a Greek slave from centuries earlier, who still gives his name to many modern collections of them, Aesop's Fables. But in Rome, another key figure who adapted earlier versions and composed new ones with a specifically Roman spin was Phaedrus, an ex-slave from the imperial household who wrote during the reign of Tiberius in the early 1st century CE. Many of these stories sharply encapsulate the inequities of Roman society and the point of view from the bottom up by pitting the little animals of the world, such as foxes, frogs, and sheep, against the creatures of power in the shape of lions, eagles, wolves, and hawks. Very occasionally, the underdog manages to win. A mother fox, for example, recovers her babies, which a mother eagle has snatched as food for her own young. The fox starts a fire, and the eagle releases the cubs to rescue her own brood. But usually the dice are stacked against the powerless. In one story, a cow, a goat, and a sheep go into partnership with a lion. But when they together capture a large, tasty stag, the lion takes it all and refuses to share. In another, a crane puts her head down the throat of a wolf to remove a bone on which the animal was choking, but is cheated of the promised reward. "Wasn't it enough," the wolf demands, "that she didn't get her head bitten off?" Overall, the message is a striking contrast with the optimistic fantasies of gambling. The only real option, many of these fables insist, is to put up with one's lot. The frogs ask Jupiter to give them a king, and he gives them a log. When they ask for a better one, they are given a snake, which eats them up. A little jackdaw, who dresses himself up in fine feathers as a grand peacock, is rejected as an impostor by the peacocks, and rejected again, this time as a bird getting above himself, when he tries to return to the jackdaws. It is the Trimalchio story in a very different guise, and from a very different point of view. One thing is for certain. There is no help for any of these poor creatures in the forces of the law. That is horribly demonstrated in the story of a swallow returning from abroad, who has built her nest in the wall of a courtroom and hatched 7 eggs there. A serpent came along while the mother was away and devoured all the nestlings. The law might protect the rights of some, so the fable's moral runs, but not of the poor young swallows, whose murder took place under the judges' noses. Swallows and Serpents. Given the huge gulf between the haves and have-nots in the Roman world, why was there not more open social and political conflict? How was it that in the city of Rome, the emperor and a few thousand of the wealthy, plus their slave staff, managed to monopolize acres of land, including sprawling mansions and spacious pleasure parks around the city's edge, when close to 1 million people were crammed into the space left over? Why, to put it in terms of the fable, did the swallows not rise up in revolt against the serpents? One answer is that there was probably more conflict than is recorded, even if it was for the most part guerrilla warfare rather than outright revolt. Rotten eggs thrown at the curtains of passing sedan chairs rather than coordinated assaults on the gates of the imperial palace. Roman writers did not have much of an eye for moderate levels of unrest. But emperors were certainly anxious about the kind of reception they would receive when they went to public games and spectacles. And although public order did not repeatedly break down under the rule of the emperors, as it had in the conflicts of the late Republic, there is evidence of occasional violent riots in Rome and in other towns of the empire. The main cause was disruption to the food supply. In 51 CE, Claudius was pelted with bread in the forum, an odd weapon in a food shortage, you might think, and had to be smuggled into the palace by a back door. At roughly the same time, in Aspendos, in modern Turkey, one local official only narrowly escaped being burned alive by an angry crowd protesting against the landowners who had locked their grain away, intending it for export. But food was not the only issue. In 61 CE, a leading senator was murdered by one of his slaves, and the Senate decided to follow the traditional rules for such a crime, which insisted that all of the victim's slaves be put to death along with the guilty party. The threat of such a punishment was meant to encourage slaves to inform on one another. On this occasion, there were 400 of them altogether, all innocent. The people took to the streets in outrage at the severity of what was proposed, and in a display of solidarity between the slaves and the free population, many of whom would have once been slaves themselves. But even though a significant number of senators were on the side of the rioters, the Emperor Nero brought the troops in to prevent trouble and had the sentence carried out. Another answer is that, despite the vast disparities of wealth, the disdain of the elite for the less fortunate, and the glaring double standards, there was a greater cultural overlap between the rich and at least the middling people of Rome, or those on the lower floors of the insular blocks, than we might imagine. Scratch the surface, and the two cultures prove to be more permeable than they first seem. The outlook of the swallows, not always so drastically different from the outlook of the serpents. We have already seen some hints of that, the speech bubbles in the bar, and the cleverly written epitaphs, sometimes composed as poetry, with all the complex rules governing that in Latin, suggest a world where the ability to read and write was taken for granted. There have been endless, inconclusive debates in recent years about exactly how many of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire were literate. Across the Roman world as a whole, country and town, the number may have been very low, well under 20% of adult men, but it must have been much higher than that in urban communities, where many small traders, craftsmen and slaves would have needed some level of basic literacy and numeracy to function successfully in their jobs, taking the orders, counting the cash, organising deliveries and so on. There are indications, too, that functional literacy of that sort gave even the middling people some stake in what we would think of as high classical culture. There are more than 50 quotations from the poetry of Virgil scrawled as graffiti on the walls of Pompeii. That certainly does not mean that the Aeneid or his other poems were widely read in their entirety. The majority of the quotes are of the first words of the first book of the Aeneid. Arma verumque cano, arms and the man I sing. Or the first words of the second book. Conticuere omnes, everyone fell silent. Lines that had probably become as quotable as to be or not to be, and many of them might have been the work of rich lads for whom Virgil was a school textbook. It is a fallacy to imagine that only the poor write on walls. But it would be implausible to suppose that all of these scrawlings had a rich pedigree. The signs are that, even if in bite-sized chunks, Virgil's poetry was one shared cultural commodity to be quoted, adapted, and even used for jokes and play. The facade of one Pompeian laundry was decorated with a scene taken from the story of the Aeneid, showing the hero Aeneas leading his father and son from the wreckage of Troy on their way to found the new Troy in Italy. Just nearby, some joker scrawled in a parody of the famous first line of the poem, Folones ululamque cano, non arma verumque. The fullers and their owl I sing, not arms and the man. referring to the bird that was a trade mascot of the laundry business. It was hardly high culture, but it does point to a shared frame of reference between the world of the street and the world of classic literature. An even more striking case of that is found in the decoration of a bar designed in the 2nd century CE in the port town of Ostia. The main theme of the painting is the standard ancient lineup of Greek philosophers and gurus, traditionally grouped under the title of the Seven Sages. They include Thales of Miletus, the 6th century BCE thinker, famous for claiming that water was the origin of the universe, and his rough contemporaries, Solon of Athens, an almost legendary lawgiver, and Chilon of Sparta, another early luminary and intellectual. Some of the paintings have not survived, but originally the full seven would have been there, shown seated on elegant chairs and carrying scrolls. But there was a surprise, for each of them was accompanied by a slogan, not on their specialist subjects of politics, science, law, or ethics, but on defecation, and running along a familiar scatological theme. Above Thales ran the words, "Thales advised those who shit hard to really work at it." Above Solon, "To shit well, Solon stroked his belly." And above Chilon, "Cunning Chilon taught how to fart without making a noise." Beneath the sages, there was another row of figures, all sitting together on a communal multi-seater lavatory, a normal arrangement in the Roman world. They too are uttering lavatorial mottos, for example, "Jump up and down and you'll go quicker," and "It's coming." One way of explaining this is as an aggressive popular joke against elite culture. The ordinary boys in the bar were enjoying some scatological fun against the pillars of the elite intellectual establishment by seeing their wisdom in terms of the lavatory. And that must be one side of it, bringing high thoughts down to the level of defecation. But it was more complicated than that. These slogans do not only assume a literate audience, or at least enough literates among the customers to be able to read the slogans to the non-literates. In order to devise and to get the joke here, you also had to know something about the seven sages. If Thales of Miletus meant absolutely nothing to you, then his advice on defecation was hardly funny. In order to take a swipe against the pretensions of intellectual life, you had to have some knowledge of it. There are many ways to imagine the life in this bar, the rowdy guffawing at the lavatorial humour, the occasional discussion about what exactly Chilon's claim to fame was, the bantering with the landlord, the flirtation with the waiting staff. The customers would have come for all kinds of reasons. To get a good hot meal, to enjoy an evening in jollier and warmer surroundings than they had at home, or simply to get drunk. Some would have been the sort to dream of the riches that came with a lucky throw of the dice. Others would have believed that it was better to put up with your lot in life rather than lose the little extra you had on the gaming board. Many would have resented the arrogance and disdain, the double standards and the lifestyle of their rich neighbours. Lack of zoning in Roman cities may have had its equitable side, but it also meant that the poor constantly had their noses rubbed in the privilege of others. What all would have agreed, both rich and poor, was that to be rich was a desirable state, that poverty was to be avoided if you possibly could. Just as the ambition of Roman slaves was usually to gain freedom for themselves, not to abolish slavery as an institution, so the ambitions of the poor were not radically to reconfigure the social order, but to find a place for themselves nearer the top of the hierarchy of wealth. Apart from a very few philosophical extremists, no one in the Roman world seriously believed that poverty was honourable. Until the growth of Christianity, which we shall explore further in the next chapter. The idea that the rich man might have a problem entering the kingdom of heaven would have seemed as preposterous to those hanging out in our Ostian bar as to the plutocrat in his mansion. Chapter 12. Rome outside Rome, Pliny's province, In 109 CE, Pliny the Younger left Italy and his lavish country villa to travel for at least 4 weeks over almost 2,000 miles to the province of Bithynia. Lawyer, advocate and ex-consul, then in his late 40s, he was the new provincial governor appointed by the Emperor Trajan with a special mandate to look into the condition of the cities there. His was a large territory stretching along much of the southern shore of the Black Sea and covering more than 15,000 square miles, including the rump of Mithridates' old kingdom of Pontus. As his companion, Pliny took his third wife, Calpurnia, some 25 years his junior. There were no living children from any of his marriages. She went home a couple of years later, on receiving news of the death of her grandfather. Pliny never returned to Italy. The likelihood is that he died in post not long after Calpurnia left. What Pliny did as governor is known from roughly 100 surviving letters he exchanged with the emperor during his time in Bithynia on the organisation and administration of the province, on legal disputes, urban regeneration, financial management and imperial protocol. Whoever selected and edited these for public circulation, for they are certainly not the random contents of Pliny's filing cabinet, was concerned to present him as a safe pair of hands, a man of probity, with an eye for detail, who took the business of provincial administration seriously. He often comes across as a bit too good to be true. The letters show him scrupulously inspecting the finances of the local towns, reporting to the emperor on the state of their public services and asking for architects and engineers to be sent from Rome. Pliny was worried about the state of the aqueduct at Nicomedia, the baths at Claudiopolis, and the theatre and gymnasium at Nicaea. Even the 6-metre-thick wall in this new gymnasium was not structurally sound, he suspected, but a specialist opinion was needed. At Nicomedia, he considered establishing a local fire brigade, though Trajan advised against the plan, on the revealing grounds that such organisations could turn into political pressure groups, and suggested simply providing some firefighting equipment instead. Pliny fretted, too, about how to punish slaves who had tried to enrol in the army, which was strictly open to the freeborn only, about whether the town of Nicaea should be allowed to appropriate the property of anyone who died without making a will, and about whether Trajan would mind having his statue put up in a building where human remains were buried. Any advice from the emperor would have taken at least 2 months to get back to Pliny, even assuming an instant turnaround at the palace end. But Trajan did regularly reply, and an occasional tone of irritation suggests that the letters were dictated or drafted by the man himself, rather than simply passed across the desk of some underling. Of course, he growls, he would not mind the proximity of human remains to his statue. How on earth could Pliny ever have imagined that he would take that as an insult? It would probably have surprised both Pliny and Trajan to discover that 2,000 years later, the most famous of their exchanges is to do with an apparently insignificant but awkward and time-consuming new religious group, the Christians. Pliny admitted that he was not sure how to handle them. To start with, he had given them several opportunities to recant and executed only those who would not do so. Their stubbornness and unbending obstinacy certainly ought to be punished. But then many more names were brought to his attention, as people started to settle old scores by accusing their enemies of being Christian. Pliny continued to allow those under investigation to recant, so long as they proved their sincerity by pouring wine and incense in front of statues of the emperor and the true gods. But in order to find out what was at the bottom of all this, he had 2 Christian slave women tortured and questioned. In both ancient Greece and Rome, slaves were allowed to give legal evidence only under torture, and concluded that Christianity was nothing other than a perverse and unruly superstition. He still wanted Trajan to confirm that this had been the right method of approach. And that is more or less what the emperor did, though he added a note of caution. Christians should not be sought out, he wrote. But if they are accused and found guilty, they must be punished. This is the earliest surviving discussion of Christianity outside Jewish or Christian literature. The contrast with Cicero's letters sent from Cilicia 150 years earlier could hardly be starker. For Cicero, the province presented the opportunity for military exploits and offered dreams of Alexander the Great, and it was a man's world. In the Republic, governors' wives seem to have been expressly prohibited from accompanying their husbands abroad. He paints a picture of uncertainty and disorganisation that, for all his good intentions, he could only mitigate, not solve. And that was combined with persistent low-level exploitation of the local population by many of the Roman provincial staff, including Caesar's assassin Brutus, whose high political principles did not apply to all. He had been trying to extract 48% interest from the unfortunate Cypriots. Pliny appears to have had no aspirations to armed heroics, and he was there with his wife, though what young Calpurnia spent her time doing we can only guess. His province comes across as an ordered place, where good financial practices were enforced and corruption sniffed out, where the local amenities were high on the governor's agenda, and disputes were resolved within a clear legal framework. It would be wrong to take this contrast entirely at face value. Dispatches back to the emperor are almost bound to have had a different flavour and given a different impression, from letters like Cicero's to close friends and confidants. Besides, some of the specific legal framework within which Pliny was operating went back to the era of Cicero. For it was Pompey who had established the regulations for the new province after his defeat of Rome's long-standing enemy, Mithridates, in the 60s BCE, and Pliny, on several occasions, refers back to them explicitly as the Lex Pompeia or Pompeian Code. And even Cicero occasionally turns his attention to the irregularities going on in the provincial towns. Nevertheless, there was a new style of government in the provinces from the reign of Augustus onwards, and Pliny's correspondence captures this well. There was a new clarity of command. Pliny had gone out to Bithynia with specific instructions from Trajan, and he knew exactly to whom he should report. It is clear, too, that the emperor could make decisions about matters in the provinces right down to detailed questions on particular buildings, in particular towns, in a way that the Senate of the Republic never had. Some rogue governors might have liked to behave as mini-autocrats, acting on their own initiative, laying down their own law, and living a lavish lifestyle, largely out of touch with the capital. And not all of them were entirely loyal to the man on the throne. There was, however, a new sense that governors were officials, directly answerable to a higher authority back in Rome. As we shall see, the palace administration, although several weeks' journey from many provinces, had ways of keeping track of what these officials were up to far from home. This was a new world of Rome outside Rome, and Pliny is a good guide to it. His letters raise questions about how far the empire under the emperors was different from the empire under the republic, whether for the governed or the governing, victors or victims. They point to wider dilemmas over official relations with the Christians, which eventually became one of the most divisive conflicts across the Roman world, and hint at many important issues in the infrastructure of imperial rule at this period, from the role of soldiers in provincial administration to the organisation of official transport. But Pliny had his blind spots too. He had little eye for any general sources of opposition to the Romans or for the commercial opportunities of this huge empire, and none at all for the cultural differences between his province and his home. No one would guess from the correspondence that the main language of his province was Greek, not Latin. Trajan at one point does pass an opinion on Greek fitness regimes. Greeklings, he writes, meaning the Greek-speaking provincials, do love their gymnasia. But the closest Pliny comes to remarking on cultural variety is when he deems Christianity a perverse and unruly superstition and tries to get to the bottom of its rituals and ceremonies. The province of Bithynia and Pontus, as it was technically known, was a world away from Rome, with a dazzling and sometimes exotic mix of Greek and other local traditions, as some other ancient writers were keen to underline. The essayist and satirist Lucian, himself a striking example of cultural hybridity, being a Roman citizen from Syria whose first language was Greek, devoted a whole skit to an unforgettably weird new oracle that emerged in the province just 50 years after Pliny's death. It featured a prophetic snake with a human head and was hugely popular, attracting the attention of elite Romans from the emperor Marcus Aurelius down. Lucian ridiculed it as a money-making fraud with a homemade puppet at its centre. For historians now, one of the most pressing questions of the Roman Empire is precisely how cultural differences and oddities of this kind were debated, how Roman those outside Rome and Italy became, and how people in the provinces related their traditions, religions, languages, and in some cases, literatures to those of the imperial power, and vice versa. Pliny does not seem to have been the slightest bit interested in this. The boundaries of empire. The expansion of the empire by the first Augustus had come to an abrupt end in 9 CE, when, in the course of stabilizing Roman conquests in Germany, the Roman commander, Publius Quinctilius Varus, lost most of 3 legions at the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, just north of the modern town of Osnabrück. It was a defeat that ranked in Roman imagination with the disaster at Cannae during the war against Hannibal, and lurid stories were told of how captured soldiers were sacrificed in barbaric rituals, and how the gales and pouring rain made the massacre worse. It was said that the helpless Romans could not fire their arrows, throw their javelins, or even wield their soaking shields. In the end, the casualties came not too far short of 10% of the Roman armed forces. The remains of some of them, plus their pack animals, have recently been discovered on the site, including skulls with traces of deep head wounds. The victorious enemy was a German rebel, Arminius. Herman the German, as he is now affectionately known, a man who had served in the Roman army and whom Varus had trusted as a loyal friend. Arminius tricked Varus into the ambush after saying that he was going off to raise local support for the Romans. As on other occasions, the most effective opponents of the legions were those whom the Romans themselves had trained. Augustus had been planning to expand Roman territory into eastern Germany beyond the River Rhine. Clear signs of his intentions have been discovered over the past 20 years in the excavations of a half-finished Roman town at Valgamis, 60 miles east of the river. Its central forum was already constructed, complete with a gilded statue of the emperor on horseback. It was never finished because after the disaster, Augustus gave up plans for more conquests, withdrew westwards, and at his death left instructions that the empire should not be extended any further. Those instructions were not, however, quite so simple, for, as we have seen, Augustus also left a template for imperial power that was founded on conquest and on traditional Roman military prowess. And he bequeathed to his successors, and to the Roman people, a vision of the Roman Empire extending over the whole world. Could Jupiter's prophecy in Virgil's Aeneid that the Romans would have power without limit be conveniently shelved just because of a single disaster? That was hardly the spirit of Cannae. For the next 200 years, until the end of the 2nd century CE, those 2 incompatible visions of empire, consolidation versus expansion, coexisted surprisingly easily. There were a few additions to Roman territory. Claudius, for example, compensated for his decidedly unmilitary image by taking the credit for conquering Britain, and celebrated the event with a triumphal procession in 44 CE, the first in almost 30 years. This had considerable symbolic value. It was the first Roman conquest in those strange lands that lay beyond the ocean, otherwise known in this case as the English Channel, and turned Julius Caesar's temporary foray onto the island 100 years earlier into permanent occupation. But it was hardly expansion on a grand scale. And over the next decades, it proceeded northwards to Scotland very slowly indeed. The careful assessment by the geographer Strabo, writing in the early 1st century CE of the viability of annexing Britain, is in fact a telling illustration of a newly cautious imperial culture. After reviewing the characteristics of the Britons, tall, bandy-legged and weird, and the resources of the island, including grain, cattle, slaves and hunting dogs, he argues that the cost of the garrison would outweigh any tax revenue that would accrue. But Claudius needed the kudos. Only Trajan's campaigns led to any significant expansion of the empire. Through 101 and 102 CE, he conquered Dacia, part of what is now Romania, in the operations that are depicted in detail on his column. Between 114 and 117 CE, he invaded Mesopotamia and went beyond, as far as modern Iran. This was the furthest east that Roman power was ever formally to extend, but not for long. Within days of coming to the throne in 117 CE, Hadrian abandoned most of the territory. The success was celebrated in a particularly bizarre triumphal procession. As Trajan had died on the way home, an effigy took his place in the triumphal chariot, and anyway, the conquered lands had already been handed back. Many obstacles slowed down foreign conquests. The instructions of Augustus were one thing, but few posthumous wishes hold as much weight as the dead had hoped for while alive. The end of the competitive republican political culture was more important. The emperors, who claimed the glory of military success, whether they participated in the fighting or not, were mainly competing with their dead predecessors, a much less intense rivalry than that between, say, Sulla and Marius, or Pompey and Caesar. This went hand in hand with a growing sense that the empire might, in practical terms, have boundaries, even if the extravagant prophecy in the Aeneid was never forgotten. That did not mean a fixed frontier in a precise sense. There was always a fuzzy zone where Roman control faded gradually into non-Roman territory, and there were always peoples who were not formally part of the provinces of the empire, but nevertheless did what the Romans told them to, on the old model of obedience. That is why modern maps that claim to plot the edges of the empire in a simple line can be more misleading than helpful. But the edges were gradually becoming less fluid and more important, as the wall constructed in northern Britain on the orders of Hadrian suggests. Hadrian's Wall, as we call it, stretched for more than 70 miles, right across the island from one coast to the other. Its construction was an enormous investment of military man-hours, but it is surprisingly hard to know what exactly it was for. The old idea that it was a defensive structure to keep the barbarians out is unconvincing. It is true that the one ancient writer to mention its construction, an anonymous biographer and fantasist writing at the end of the 4th century CE, though for some unknown reason he pretends to be writing a century earlier, refers to Hadrian separating Romans and barbarians. But it could hardly have deterred any reasonably spirited and well-organized enemies who were keen to scale it, especially as much of it was built only of turf, unlike the solid stone sections that star in most photographs. Without a walkway along the top, it was not even well designed for surveillance and patrol purposes. But as a customs barrier, which is one recent suggestion, or as an attempt to control the movement of people more generally, it seems a more hefty construction than was necessary. What it asserts is Roman power over the landscape, while also hinting at a sense of ending. It may be no coincidence that other, rather less dramatic walls, banks and fortifications were developed in other frontier zones at roughly the same period, as if to suggest that the boundaries of Roman power were beginning to take a more physical form. No one, however, who looked around Rome and many other cities of the empire could possibly have guessed that the project of world conquest had been dampened. Images of Roman victory and barbarian defeat were everywhere. Diplomatic deals with inconvenient neighbours were greeted with spectacular displays, as if they had been achieved by force of arms. After a rather inglorious peace agreement with Tiridates, the king of Armenia, Nero persuaded him in 66 CE to travel the thousands of miles to Rome to receive his crown from the emperor himself, who was dressed up in the costume of a triumphing general and is reputed to have covered the whole of the theatre of Pompey in gold leaf for the day, to make it literally dazzling. Victories in defensive wars against internal enemies, rebels and invaders were commemorated as if they were glorious military achievements fought on Roman terms. The column of Marcus Aurelius, for example, finished in 193 CE and towering those careful few metres above its Trajanic rival, celebrates campaigns that were a successful but extremely costly response to a German invasion. And everywhere there were statues of emperors in splendid suits of armour and images of conquered, bound and trampled barbarians. Perhaps that was the easiest way to reconcile the conflicting legacy of the first Augustus. Art and symbol could usefully compensate for the fact that in real life there was less trampling of barbarians now going on. The management of empire. In practice, if not in the Roman imagination, the empire of the first 2 centuries CE became less of a field of conquest and pacification, and more a territory to be managed, policed, and taxed. Scipio Aemilianus and Mummius would have been amazed to discover that the cities of Carthage and Corinth, that they had devastated in 146 BCE, had been refounded on Julius Caesar's initiative as settlements of veteran soldiers, and by the end of the 1st century CE were two of the most prosperous towns in a very different sort of Roman world. This was the result not of any imperial grand plan, but of a gradual process of change, a series of minor adjustments and shifts. So far as we can tell, even under the rule of the emperors, there was hardly any such thing as a general policy for running the empire, or an overarching strategy of military deployment. The directive of Augustus against further conquest in general was a rare intervention of that sort. Although major construction projects, such as Hadrian's Wall, must have been the result of some decision at a high level, for the most part, the emperor's involvement was on the pattern of Trajan's in Bithynia, dealing with issues as and when they came up. The emperor did represent a new tier in the structure of command, but his role was largely a reactive one. He was not a strategist or forward planner. Pliny, in other words, was not the nervous fusspot that he sometimes seems to modern readers of his letters, bombarding the boss with questions on all kinds of trivia. He was following the logic of Roman imperial administration, that you got no decision from the emperor unless you asked him for one. Whether or not the government of the provinces was better or fairer in the first 2 centuries CE than it had been in the last century of the Republic depended on who or where you were. It is too easy to compare the diligent Pliny with Cicero, or even more obviously, the extortionate Verres, and to claim on the basis of some entirely unrepresentative or misrepresented individuals a vast improvement. Some things no doubt did improve. There was a gradual move away from the big companies of tax collectors, whose incentive had always been to extract as much cash from the provincials as possible. The system remained very mixed, and the publicani continued to play a part, but much more of the collecting was made the responsibility of the locals, which was also the cheapest option. In most provinces, too, a specialist financial officer or procurator appointed by the emperor, looked after the imperial estates, and had a watching brief over the tax collection. He and his staff of slaves and ex-slaves from the imperial household, the familia Kizaris, as it was known, could also keep an eye on what the governor was up to, and are known sometimes to have blown the whistle back in Rome. But the truth is that, on the ground, the standard of government was as varied as it had ever been. Trials for extortion and malpractice in the provinces continued, which may equally well be a sign of the persistent flouting of the law as of its proper enforcement. Many kinds of day-to-day exploitation of the provincials were simply taken for granted. The Emperor Tiberius summed up the basic ethics of Roman rule rather well when he said, in reaction to some excessive profits turned in from the provinces, "I want my sheep shorn, not shaven." It was out of the question that provincial fleeces should be left as they were. One regular irritant was the need to provide transport and lodgings for Roman officials. The governor's staff did not have their own fleet of official vehicles. The courier taking the post to Rome or the governor travelling from city to city was expected to requisition transport on the spot, horses, mules and carts. A small fee was payable, but the locals had no choice but to provide what was asked. Unsurprisingly, a large number of Roman hangers-on tried to take advantage of this rather than make their own costly and inconvenient arrangements. Pliny gave his wife an official travel voucher so that she could get back to Italy quickly when her grandfather died. He felt the need, after the event, to confess this bending of the rules to Trajan, but he did it all the same. The new method of appointing governors might have led to some more responsible candidates. This was now directly or indirectly in the hands of the emperor, rather than the result of a mixture of drawing lots and political chicanery in the Senate. But the emperor's criteria for choice were not only, and maybe not often, the ability of the candidate or the interests of the provincials. If Trajan really had wanted a careful administrator to look into the problems of local government in Bithynia, then in Pliny he got his man. But it was a common joke, and possibly true, that Nero had appointed his friend Marcus Salvius Otho, a man who shared many of the emperor's enthusiasms, to be the governor of the province of Lusitania in modern Portugal and Spain, simply so he could more easily enjoy his affair in Rome with Otho's ex-wife, Poppaea. Even if appointments were usually made on less whimsical grounds, there is no sign of any training or briefing for the job beyond a few instructions, mandata, given by the emperor. We can only wonder how on earth the new governor managed, when he had been sent to some remote northern province he had never visited, whose native language he did not understand, whose strange customs he had heard rumours of, where he knew no one but a wary procurator, and which he was supposed to manage for anything up to 5 years or so. From this point of view, it must have seemed a journey into the dark unknown. What is certain is that the Romans made hardly any attempts, even during this more leisurely phase of imperial control, to impose their cultural norms or to eradicate local traditions. They did try to stamp out the Druids in Britain. The reports of the human sacrifice they practiced may have been hugely exaggerated, and in any case it was a ritual not entirely unknown in Rome. But it was not something that Roman authorities were prepared to tolerate in these strange foreign priests. There was also the special case of the Christians, but those were exceptions. The eastern half of the empire continued largely to operate in Greek, not Latin. Local calendars were not much adjusted, apart from occasionally realigning to the life cycle of the emperor or celebrating his achievements. Travelling around the empire meant not just crossing time zones in our sense, but moving between entirely different ways of calculating dates or hours of the day. How anyone managed their diary is a mystery. Local traditions flourished in everything from clothing, trousers and Greek cloaks, to religion. It was a world full of gods and of festivals in a vast variety whose strangeness lost nothing in the telling. The oracular snake with a human head does not look quite so odd when seen against the Egyptian Anubis, part jackal and part human, or the so-called Syrian goddess, also satirised by Lucian, whose rituals were supposed to have involved participants climbing up huge stone phalluses at the goddess's sanctuary. Romans may well not have wanted to impose any such norms, but even if that had been their aim, they did not have the manpower to achieve it. A reasonable estimate is that across the empire at any one time, there were fewer than 200 elite Roman administrators, plus maybe a few thousand slaves of the emperor, who had been sent out from the imperial centre to govern an empire of more than 50 million people. Pliny refers just to his deputy, Legatus, and the procurator. So how did they do it? The army was one answer. Over the first few decades of the rule of the emperors, soldiers were recruited increasingly from outside Italy. The provincials were, in practice, guarding the empire, were more and more stationed towards the edges of the Roman world, safely away from Rome on the Augustan model, and became heavily involved in administrative as well as frontline jobs. This is vividly illustrated by the letters and documents recovered over the past 40 years from excavations at the small army base of Vindolanda, just south of Hadrian's Wall, which housed one unit of the wall's Roman garrison. Originally scratched on wax and preserved by the still faint traces on the surviving wood underneath, they date to the early 2nd century CE. This is the other side of the Roman world, but they are roughly contemporary with the correspondence of Pliny and Trajan. The documents give a very different impression of Roman barracks life from the usual image of an exclusively male, highly militarized regime. To be sure, they include hints at armed skirmishes and some dismissive comments about the natives. Where Trajan referred to Greeklings, Graeculi, loving their gymnasia, some soldier from the wall referred to little Brits, Britunculi, a similarly patronising diminutive, throwing their javelins without getting on horseback. But it is the everyday domestic and the housekeeping side of Vindolanda that is especially interesting. One letter is an invitation to a birthday party from the camp commandant's wife to a female friend, and despite the legal prohibitions on marriages for serving soldiers in the ranks, the discovery in the excavations of a significant number of women's and children's leather shoes confirms the presence of women on the base. Of course, shoes cannot tell us what exactly their wearers were doing or how permanent a fixture they were, but it looks very much as if family life was going on here. Equally telling is a strength report, a register of the soldiers on the base and those off on other duties. More than half of the 752 were absent or unavailable for work. Of those, 337 were at a neighbouring camp. 31 were sick, eye inflammation being a bigger problem than wounds, and almost 100 were busy with other responsibilities. 46 were 300 miles away in London as the governor's bodyguard. One more had been assigned to an unspecified office, and several centurions, NCOs, were on business in other parts of the country. This fits perfectly with one of Trajan's worries in his letters to Pliny. Too many soldiers were off doing other things and were absent from their units. The other answer to how the Romans managed is that the local populations played a big part in running the empire through the towns and cities across the Roman world that Rome either supported or founded. The city, polis, had been the defining institution in Greece and the East long before the coming of Rome, and it remained so afterwards, sometimes with a considerable injection of Roman cash. The Emperor Hadrian, for example, sponsored massive building programs in Athens. In the north and west of the empire, where this had not been the case, the foundation of towns from scratch on a Roman model was the most significant impact of Roman conquest on the provincial landscape. This was exactly what Augustus's forces had been doing at Vulgamis, before the emperor gave the orders for retreat, and many of the towns of modern Britain, including London, owe their sites to Roman choices and planning. Some are more successful than others. There must be a sad story behind the Mediterranean-style outdoor swimming pool in the Roman baths at Viriconium, modern Wroxeter, near the English-Welsh border, which did not survive many frosty winters and soon became the town's rubbish dump. And the habits of urban life would have meant little or nothing to the majority of the population, who continued to live, as they always had done, in the country. But in the West, as well as the East, a network of more or less self-governing towns came to be the foundation of Roman administration. Only when things were thought to be going wrong did someone like Pliny interfere in them. It was urbanization on an unprecedented scale. The provincial or native elites living in these towns acted as the crucial middlemen between the Roman governor with his tiny staff and the provincial population at large. It was through them that much taxation was raised, and that an acceptable degree of loyalty, or at least absence of trouble, was ensured. It was probably some of them, too, who met that nervous new governor as he took his first steps in the province. The details of these arrangements and encounters would have been very different in different parts of the empire. The literary salons of Roman Athens had almost nothing in common with the beer gardens of Roman Colchester. But the same underlying logic operated across the empire. Pre-existing local hierarchies were transformed into hierarchies that served Rome, and the power of local leaders was harnessed to the needs of the imperial ruler. In Britain, a native ruler by the name of Togidubnus was a classic case of this. He had been on the Roman side when the Claudian forces invaded in 43 CE, and was likely some sort of ally before that, for remote and rural as Britain was, there had been links between its aristocracy and mainland Europe since at least the time of Caesar's invasions in the 50s BCE. Togidubnus may or may not have been the owner of the large villa near Chichester, now known rather grandly as Fishbourne Roman Palace. The connection is purely guesswork, but he was certainly given Roman citizenship, and with it the new Roman name of Tiberius Claudius Togidubnus. And there is clear evidence that he continued to act as a local source of authority in the pacified areas of the new province. What originally lay behind this system of government was at least as much simple necessity as ideological vision. Outside the areas of active fighting, Romans were simply too few in number to govern in any other way. But the character of imperial rule was increasingly defined by its collaboration with the elite of the subject peoples. They, in turn, increasingly identified their interests with the Romans, both culturally and politically. They came to feel that they had a stake in the Roman project as insiders rather than outsiders, and some of the most successful in due course took a place as Roman citizens in the central government of Rome. For these men and their families, the experience of Roman rule was partly the experience of becoming Roman. Romanization and resistance. The historian Tacitus has some characteristically shrewd and cynical things to say about this process of Romanization, as it is now often called. They come in the short biography he wrote of his father-in-law, Gnaeus Julius Agricola, who served as the governor of Britain from 77 to 85 CE, an unusually long period. Most of Tacitus's account concerns Agricola's successful military operations in the province, his extension of Roman power northwards into Caledonia, Scotland, and the jealousy of the Emperor Domitian, who refused him the honour and glory he deserved for his success. The biography is as much a critique of autocracy as it is a eulogy of Tacitus's distinguished relative. The overriding message is that the imperial regime allowed no place for traditional Roman virtue and military prowess. Occasionally, however, Tacitus turns to the civilian aspects of Agricola's government of the province. Some of the topics are fairly routine and would not have looked out of place in the letters of Pliny, who is a friend of Tacitus's in the literary circles of early 2nd century CE Rome. Agricola is praised for keeping his household under tight control, as hard a job for many as actually governing the province. He also sorted out some of the abuses in army requisitioning, and he put money into enhancing the towns of Britain with new temples and Roman-style public buildings. It is rather more surprising to discover he had a local education policy too. He made sure that the sons of the leading provincials were educated in the liberal arts, literally, the intellectual pursuits suited to the free, and in the Latin language. And soon, as Tacitus puts it, the Britons were dressing up in togas and taking their first steps on the path to vice, thanks to porticos, baths, and banquets. He sums this up in pithy sentence. They call it, in their ignorance, civilization, but it was really part of their enslavement. Humanitas vocabatur, cum pars servitius esset. This has been hugely influential, for better or worse, in modern attempts to understand how the Roman Empire worked. In one respect, it is the sharpest analysis there is of Roman government in the western part of the empire, but not the east. No official from Rome would have dreamt of instructing the Greeks in civilization like this. However snobbish Tacitus was about the naive ignorance of these poor provincials, who have left no written account of their perspective on these transactions, however cynical he was about slavery masquerading as sophistication, he saw straight through to the connection between culture and power, and realised that by becoming Roman, the Britons were doing the conqueror's work for them. But in other ways, Tacitus's comments give a seriously misleading impression of what was going on. For a start, if Agricola really did promote an organised programme of education in the way Tacitus suggests, inculcating Roman habits into the upper echelons of British society, he was the only provincial governor, so far as we know, to do that. Romanisation was not usually something that was imposed directly from above. It was much more a consequence of the provincial elites opting in to a version of Roman culture. It was bottom-up rather than top-down. Tacitus would no doubt have objected that, given the balance of military and political power, which was so overwhelmingly in Rome's favour, it was not exactly a free choice. That is true, but nonetheless, on a practical day-to-day level, the relatively well-off urban population of the provinces became the agents of their own Romanisation, not the objects of a concerted Roman campaign of cultural reprogramming or a civilising mission. The evidence of archaeology makes it clear that they opted for new Roman forms in everything, from architecture and town planning, through crockery and kitchenware, to fabrics, food and drink. There are a few choice Roman items found buried in British graves, even before the conquest of 43 CE. And as early as the beginning of the 1st century BCE, the same Greek visitor to Gaul, who had been shocked to find enemy heads pinned up outside huts, also spotted that, despite what Caesar had to say about local distaste for the grape, the richer locals had started to quaff imported wine, leaving traditional Gallic beer to the less well-off. By the beginning of the 2nd century CE, there were rather fewer beer gardens and rather more wine bars in Roman Colchester, or that, at least, is what the surviving fragments of the jars used to transport the wine suggest. And for the first time at the start of another long tradition whose origins lie in the Roman Empire, a substantial quantity of wine was being made in what is now France, outperforming the Italian vintages. There was a dynamic combination of forces at work here. On the one hand, the power of Rome made Roman culture an aspirational goal. On the other, Rome's traditional openness meant that those who wished to do it the Roman way were welcome to do so, and of course, it suited the stable maintenance of Roman rule that they should. The main beneficiaries, or victims, as Tacitus saw it, were the wealthy. But they were not the only ones to create a Roman identity for themselves. A surprising glimpse into a different way of becoming Roman comes from the potteries of southern Gaul, which, during a boom in the 1st and 2nd centuries CE, produced, on an industrial scale, some of the most characteristic Roman shiny red tableware. The names of many of the individual potters have been preserved on rosters and lists found at the pottery site. There are still arguments about exactly how to read them, but they appear to be a mixed bag of both characteristically Latin names, Vericundus Bucundus, and Celtic ones, Petricos Matugenos. This is not so on the pots themselves. When these same men came to stamp their names into the plates and bowls that would be put on sale as their handiwork, many of them Romanized. Petricos called himself Quartus, Matugenos became Felix. There may have been a narrowly commercial incentive here. Customers buying Roman-style pottery produced in southern Gaul might have been attracted by an authentically Roman maker's name, but it is also possible that, for the public face of their trade, these successful but relatively humble craftsmen saw themselves as at least partly Roman and embraced one version of Romanness. Version is the right way to put it, for another problem with Tacitus's analysis is that it implies a simple opposition between native and Roman cultures, or a single spectrum along which degrees of Romanness could be plotted. Togidubnus, the wine-drinking new Roman citizen, much further along the line than Petricos the potter, who used a Latin sobriquet on his work, but may have been resolutely Celtic in many other respects. In fact, the interaction between Rome and other cultures in the empire is striking for the variety of forms it took and for the very diverse hybrid versions of Roman, and sometimes not Roman, culture that were the result. Across the Roman world, all kinds of different cultural amalgams emerged, from particular local attempts to embrace, to accommodate, or to resist the imperial power. The signs of these range from the images of Roman emperors in the province of Egypt, all presented as if they were traditional Egyptian pharaohs, to the flamboyant sculpture on the facade of the temple of Sulis Minerva in the Roman town of Bath in southern England. In some respects, this is as clear a case of Romanization as you could wish. It was part of a classical temple built to a design unknown in Britain before the Roman conquest. It was put up in honour of a Celtic deity, Sulis, now seen as the equivalent of the Roman Minerva. And it includes various elements from the oak leaf roundel to the supporting figures of victory, drawn directly from the traditional Roman repertoire. But at the same time, it is a glaring example of a provincial culture either failing or, perhaps better, refusing to become Roman. The most remarkable case of this kind of interaction is found in the provinces of the Greek world, where an extraordinary literary and cultural renaissance was one result of what we would now call the colonial encounter. In the early period of Roman military expansion overseas, starting in the 3rd century BCE, Roman literature and visual art developed in dialogue with Greek models and predecessors. The poet Horace exaggerated when, in the late 1st century BCE, he summed up the process as one of simple cultural takeover. Greece, once conquered, conquered her savage victor and brought culture into the rough land of Latium. Better in Latin, Graecia capta ferrum victorem, cepit et artes, intulit agresti Latio. It was a much more complicated interrelationship than that, as Horace's own poetry shows, which is a distinctively Roman combination of homage to Greek culture, ambitious transformation of Greek literary models, and celebration of Latin traditions. But all the same, he had a point. In the Roman Empire of the first 2 centuries CE, the encounter took a different turn. It was not simply that many Greeks, like many Britons, adopted such habits as Roman-style bathing and watching gladiatorial fights. The transformation of local culture in the East was nothing like as radical as in the West, but sophisticated Greeks did not necessarily look down their noses at brutish Roman blood sports. There is clear evidence that Greek theatres and stadia were adapted for both gladiators and wild beast hunts. Traces of the fixings for the nets intended to keep the audience safe from the animals are one clear sign. But the most striking development was an outpouring of literature in Greek, in which the power of Rome either hovers in the background or is directly addressed. In playful satire, passive resistance, curiosity or admiration, the quality of this material is huge. The vast majority of all the ancient Greek literature that has survived comes from this period of imperial rule. To give a sense of scale, the work of just one of these writers, Plutarch, the 2nd century CE biographer, philosopher, essayist, and priest of the famous Greek oracle at Delphi, extends to as many modern pages as all the surviving work of the 5th century BCE put together, from the tragedies of Aeschylus to the history of Thucydides. Greek writing of the empire ranges from elaborate praise of Roman rule to obvious exercises in denial. In 144 CE, for example, Publius Aelius Aristides, better known as a hypochondriac who wrote several volumes on his illnesses, delivered his speech in honour of Rome in front of the emperor Antoninus Pius. It may have gone down well on the day, but it now makes a fairly sickening read, even for those used to probing between the lines of panegyric. Rome has surpassed all previous empires, bringing peace and prosperity to the whole world. May all the gods and their children be called upon to grant that the empire and the city itself flourish forever and do not come to an end until stones float on the sea. At roughly the same time, Pausanias was writing the 10 volumes of his guidebook to Greece, or Periegesis, in which he gives Roman rule exactly the opposite treatment, silent eradication. Whatever his story was, we know next to nothing about Pausanias' life. As he guides his travellers around the monuments, sites and customs of Greece, from Delphi to the southern Peloponnese, he simply omits to mention most of the buildings on his route erected by Romans or with Roman money. This was not so much a guidebook in the modern sense, but a literary attempt to turn the clock back and to recreate an image of a Rome-free Greece. It is, however, the prolific Plutarch who made the most systematic attempt to define the relationship between Greece and Rome, to dissect their differences and similarities, and to wonder what a Greco-Roman culture might be. In his volumes of essays on subjects as diverse as how to listen to lectures, how to tell a flatterer from a friend, and the customs of his sanctuary at Delphi, he explores the details of religion, politics, and traditions that distinguished or united the two cultures. Why, he wondered, did the Romans start the beginning of a new day at midnight? Why did Roman women wear white in mourning? But it is his parallel lives that is especially revealing, a series of pairs of biographies, 22 pairs still surviving, made up of the life story of one Greek and one Roman figure, with a short comparison at the end. He puts together 2 founding fathers, Romulus with the equally legendary Greek Theseus, 2 great orators, Cicero with the Athenian orator, Demosthenes, 2 famous conquerors, Julius Caesar with Alexander the Great.